Hey, hello, my lovely podcast friends. How are you doing? How's the life going on? I really hope you are doing fine and you are doing great. Let's have a look on what we're gonna have today on the show. First of all, it's time for the Thanksgiving. It's that special time of the year. We have the Black Friday. The OASO has new records to celebrate. It's going too well on the stock market exchange. I thought it was probably a good moment to chat about the American tax plan. We're gonna talk a bit about the educational system and the biggest bank in Suriname is bankrupt, and we have a lovely interview about the bankruptcy of Air Berlin. Having that said, then let me begin first that I'm at the moment looking for your help. I am closing and talking with a few radio stations in the New York market, and it would be really handy if I would have some sponsors to help covering the airtime. I'm talking about the time that you want to be on air, that means traffic jam hours. And I'm just wondering if you would be so friendly to send me a message if you know anyone who would be interested in sponsoring this show. It would be something like this for 1 hour on the radio in New York City, giving people the profitable moment of the day, just like you also got your profitable moment. Social media is here. Facebook, Snapchat, Twitter, Weibo, blogging, LinkedIn, Swan, Google+. But how to use them in your advantage? Get yourself the Social Media Expert course. It's the smart point to use all social media in your advantage without burning all your time. HoffProfit.com/SMM. I say HoffProfit.com/SMM. And yes, it is Thanksgiving. It is that moment and that it is a celebration time. So it's a moment also of the year that we in the Western world are remembering and celebrating what's happening. And what I would say is that it's really good. I'm really happy to see that because it's nice to see and to think about other people. You got, for example, Lidl, who's going to donate food at the food aid. But I'm always just wondering, how did those people get at the food aid first? And would an increase in financial intelligence and an increase in employment and chances to make money not be a better solution? But that's just my side on it. And it is also the more important day because we're all in the living in the capitalistic world and we have only one real day. It's Black Friday. It's that moment of the year that people are standing in line for the queue and queuing up for the lines and going into the shops, running around, getting heart attacks from the discounts because it's Black Friday. Now, and the interesting part for me is that it is just, if you look at what Black Friday was in the past, it was just the day that retail shops were making money. So just think about it. You're working all the year and from today on you are earning money. It is for me a bit like why I don't want to have an airliner, why I don't want to have a supermarket as ownership. It's not really working well. It's not a financially sensible thing to go for. And yes, you can make money in both fields, but it is just that I say there are better things to make your money in. But it's really a great thing. It's a big thing. You see also that those days are going to be globalized. You saw that the Happy Singles Day, that day is now going globally on the slow level. We have now the celebration for the Muslims when after the Ramadan, the sugar party, when they feasted and have not eat, drink or had sex during the daytime, so then the sun is up. That's also going to be globalized, and all those days are going to be globalized. And the reason is easy. We all need to make money. And I know that from a guy I know, he has a small Turkish supermarket. His company is really thriving around that Ramadan period. And people are donating stuff, but they keep buying the same things. So you will see a globalization of those shopping days because, let's face the fact, it's just a reason to get people so far to spend money. Because after Black Friday, we will get the Cyber Monday. We will get the Prime Day. I mean, there are so many great things happening. And so many things will happen. It is just lovely. Having that, I would say the special message. And don't forget, if there is someone in need, then help them. But don't do a short thing. Really help them forward. Not like, you don't give a drug addict money because then you know that he's going to put more drugs in his body. What you give a drug addict is a new surrounding. You make sure that the drugs is out of his systems. You give him a lot of vitamins and you work on his problems. That's what you do. It happened. The United Kingdom is leaving the European Union. The people have spoken and created an unprecedented happening. This creates greater investment opportunities.
They are outlined in the Profitable Brexit Report. You can find it at hofprofit.com/profitablebrexit, and during the introduction week you receive a 50% discount. So, join the highway to profitable Brexit momentum, hofprofit.com/profitablebrexit.
And the OECD has a new record achieved. It's a new great thing for their, at least in their opinion. What they have reached is the record high tax pressure on their citizens. So, and it makes sense for a government to tax its citizens, because let's face the fact, you saw it at the Panama Papers, the Paradise Papers, the LuxLeaks, and more of those things. There are a lot of company can move easily. I mean, but people are not really prepared to move around. I mean, how many people are prepared to go live as a nomad and literally fly over and spend time in different countries frequently and have no balance in where your social life is just to pay no tax? I mean, it is something, but if you are doing it, this is a status that you could get at the tax agency, and I'm getting it, or basically, yeah, well, I'm trying to figure it out for myself, and don't worry, I will get it, or to be honest, I already got that status, so no, don't worry, I don't pay tax. But it's a new record for the OECD, and they are really proud of it, and you see that the OECD is doing nothing more than blackmailing countries that have a more business and financial and sensible policies. I mean, you see that there was a lot of pressure on Monaco. It's a country that's listed in my tax-free passport report, and yes, it's legal. Monaco doesn't have any income tax, so it is a handy way to go for. And what you could do then is go live there. You don't have to pay income tax, and simply after a few years ask if you can get a local citizenship, and then you got it. And no, Monaco is not cheap. The cheapest I found to rent for your living is a studio of 2,500 euros a month. Well, it's okay. I mean, it's no problem. You can rent it. It's just that it's a lot of money. So it has to be worthwhile the money. But there's also another reason why you should go for it. You will see wars, and you see that OECD and more of those Western civilized countries, they are putting pressure on countries that try to thrive. I mean, if you look at a lot of those small countries, because all the low tax international financial centers have some things in common. It are small countries. It are basically island nations. They have no real big natural resources, and the government has a commitment to attract high-paying, trained jobs. So they don't want to have—they have no problem with having a lot of fishermen going to fish the seas, but they also want to have accountants, lawyers, people who pay a small fortune a month to all types of people. And to give you an idea about the impact of those things, when we had the financial crisis of 2007, 2008, 2009, Goldman Sachs and other investment banks were laying off staff in New York. And this caused a major boost for the unemployment in New York. Not so much that those people were gone, but there was approximately 25,000 people. Now, every one of them was spending so much money that they had kept 8 to 12 people out of benefits. So, and this is also why I think that countries should go for a sustainable financial center. And the only real sustainable financial center is with financial companies who know what they are doing, are willingly to work the slow approach, take step by step, and a government who simply says, well, yeah, we know that you are making money and our greedy vampire hands will not get your money. But that's not what is happening. The governments really need money, because there's always a new project that needs to be done that's not working. I mean, the prime example of something that's not working, at least in my opinion, is the Dutch high-speed railroad network. There was basically it's a railroad network, cost 11 billion, and there are now you have quick trains between Schiphol, Amsterdam, The Hague, Rotterdam, and yeah, I was listening to something in the backyard was happening, not sure what it is, and Antwerp, and from there, from Antwerp and from Brussels, you could connect to Eurostar, Thalys, and more of those, to Paris, and all those things. Really interesting, but we got something that was happening. There are 5 to 6 trains a day. The trains that are running there are not at full speed. It's a bit like go building a big Formula One track and go over with a bike. That's not the maximum speed. The track is built for 300 kilometers an hour. The trains are going a normal 140 to 180. Not really big. So, waste of money. And what they should have done, in my opinion, is what you saw this from day one. It was clear that the Dutch railroads need to get it. They paid a lot of money to be allowed to drive on the track. From day one, it was money losing, and the Dutch railroad did everything to get it not working. And there was a parliamentary hearing. And what I thought interesting about that hearing was that the Belgium railways, who were asked about it, and they said, yeah, we don't believe in the project, we will partner in it, but no, we are not really believing in it. We want to partner in it because we want connectivity with neighboring countries, and that makes sense. So that was their initiative, and they said, well, we had a plan to connect regional towns with regional towns, like Charleroi, a town with high youth unemployment, with Nijmegen, a student city. And the idea was to get a train frequently a day, so let's say 12 to 15 a day, to allow people, students, to start partnering together and create that interaction that students who are having, and people with brains who are having problems finding a job, could get a proper education, because there was there nothing in education, and vice versa. They said that the train Antwerp-Rotterdam would be great for both cities, and simply get an intercity run in between a lot of times a day, that's all. And then the Dutch Railroad said, "From well, we are going to run a train at maximum speed on the condition where the other high-speed trains that we are running and other trains are not running at maximum speed, so the train is going to break down, literally. It was falling apart. And look, it's just one example, because 11 billion went down the drain for basically a railroad track that's not being used properly. So it's, and for the existing, there were trains going. There was a highly popular train from Amsterdam to The Hague, Rotterdam, Dordrecht, to Roosendaal, to Antwerp and Belgium and Brussels. And they reinstated that thing, and now's the interesting part. The Dutch railroads had to promise that if they regain the train, because they were taking the biggest share and they were having the most passengers in, so that makes sense, then the Belgian railroads would not pay more than €1 million in loss on the annual basis. Well, the train is losing €1 million a month, so, and now they have to keep that train going. And what I thought most interesting was that on the parliamentary hearing, the Dutch railroads went for a new, never proven train from a company who's building trams. Okay, sounds not as a great idea to me. There was an offer from the Japanese bullet train manufacturing, who said, well, we have 15 years old trains, you can have them in 4 months. We simply put a new engine in, give them a big medical, big engineering upgrade, do everything that we need to do for the coming years. Then you can have them and you can run them for the coming 5 years. Then you will get at a high discount new high-speed rail tracks, just the next generation. That are the trains that are traveling between London and Europe, between Brussels and Paris. But and they didn't go for that. And that was just, the train was supposed to get ready and run in 2008 or 2009. The train started running in 2015, so you would already have then the new bullet trains, and it worked for less than a month. So that's it. And yeah, it's just shocking how money gets down the drain. So if people say to you that the patriotic thing to do is to pay high taxes, think about this. Would you blow money like this just ongoingly? Think about it. And if you don't want to do it, have a look at the tax-free passport report, and don't forget, the OECD, the taxes are only getting higher, so get out before you can't get out, because in the United States you saw that when it was really popular because people were disapproving with Obama's policies, and a lot of people with money said, well, then we simply move and give up our citizenship. So basically what they said was, well, we are gonna give you an exit tax. You have to pay an additional tax if you go. And that's just to make it tougher to go. And before your country get that in, get yourself out. Simply ask yourself this, what do you like more? Work literally like today to pay the bills, and your bill is mainly taxation? Or do you rather work less hard, have funny work, and have a great time in a great climate? The choice is yours, and you can tweet me at Lodewijkhoff or leave a comment below on SoundCloud. All the listeners love to making some money, but you will have to pay tax upon your money. But that's to change. You can save on your tax. Pay no tax. Completely legal. Start earning more money so you can take care for your beloved ones. So you can travel visa-free. Get yourself the tax-free passport. Get yourself the starting point to a tax-free lifestyle. A lifestyle which is an ultimate freedom. HofProfit.com/passport. I say HofProfit.com/passport. And if you also know, we all see that President Trump has launched his new tax reform plan. And there are, first of all, a few sensible things to say. There was no real big tax reform for the past decades. So a real big tax reform is what would be a good thing. And a new tax reform would be a great moment to lower taxes for everyone. Simply say, well, we're going to slash the rates with 50% for all, just to make life more favorable. I mean, if you consider that the United States is one of the highest taxed countries in the world, it's just something to think about. But there are things that they done, and the moment it's gotten a lot of momentum because there's a lot of pressure and talks about it. And yes, it's very likely that this will only benefit the rich people. Not that it is really bad, because I don't think that being rich is bad. It shows that you have brains, that you worked hard, that you worked smartly, that you did your proper thing, and you are capable of taking care of your community and your society. Yes, I know, it's just a different way to look at it, but that's really how I look at the rich people. I mean, if all the rich people would simply stop their company, then you would get a system like Venezuela, which is not really well. So that's it. And you've got, there is a, if I look at it, what's happened, there was a great tax break. There is a tax break for your private jet travel. And there's going to be a fiscal attack on the three Gulf carriers from the United States who have a lot of money, who are definitely being subsidized in the aircraft purchases. But let's face the fact, all national flag carriers are being protected, subsidized, and getting benefits from local government. So that's one thing that they are doing. And what they have to do and need to think about is, for me, it's easy what they should have done. Lower the taxes and simply say, well, why do we need a helium board? It makes sense. When the helium board was founded, was in the First World War. Then helium was military strategic. You need it for balloons and more of those things. Now you don't need it anymore for those things, so get it out. Don't have it in. And I would simply say that you need to get less of those boards and things and more common sense policies. And I was, when Trump said he was going to run for office, I was really, really, really going to hope that he would be bringing in some common sense. But I'm, for as far I can see it now, I see more and more signals that he is doing more and more of the same. And it's a pity. But there was a great opportunity to change the things for the good, to start doing common sense things. And yes, I work together with a lot of people who disagree with Trump. To be honest, the majority of the people in the Netherlands disagree with Trump. I think in Eindhoven and in the Netherlands, I'm one of the 15 people who agrees with him. So there are a lot of things, and there are a lot of sensible things you can say. And if you look at the problems, they are big. Schools are bankrupt, so it's time to get things out and sort things out. And the tax reform is a big thing, because if he can pass it, then I think that then his re-election is assured, for an easy reason. He promised two things: jobs, tax reform. Now, the tax reform, if he can pass it, even if it's so, Israel has really weird things in it, yes, he can say, well, my, you selected me, you brought me in the White House, I did what I promised to you, I got this. On the jobs, it's easy. What he needs to do is facilitate companies that they are doing things. And I know that the American government is already really helping companies out. You got great services for companies who are setting up. I'm in contact with your embassy in The Hague and people to talk about it, what's happening and how to get this podcast on air, and a lot of legal issues to check out. I mean, you have advanced to do, for example, with net neutrality rules, the FCC guidelines. I mean, it's not really a big issue, but just you need to know. And which, what's allowed, what's not allowed. If the stages I will work with, would I be allowed to sell advertisements to gun shops? Just those type of things. And, well, why not simply ask the people who know? I mean, it's their country, they know it. So that's one thing. And if you, but I mean, for me, it's just, yeah, well, set up an LLC, get to sign the contract for the slow, for the commercials, buy the time and get it out. But the interesting part on the fields of the bigger companies is, for example, Alibaba. I mean, Alibaba has $15 billion to invest into infrastructure. They are gonna invest it in 3 year time. So if he could get, let's say, half of it, of the 15 billion, that's 7.5 billion, into whatever new infrastructure Alibaba is gonna do, it would create jobs. And if he can get those jobs and some factories into to cities with no factory, no real shops and no real economic chance, and if he could simply bring in one or two of those factories a state, and yes, I know that would mean approximately 80 to 100 of those factories, but it would be a start. If people see at once that in a town like them, hey, at once, there are people working at jobs, we are earning money, factories are running well. I mean, and don't forget, on the East Coast and those blue worker states, the states that Hillary Clinton called the blue defense against Trump, which basically was not really working because the blue defense said, well, we have common sense, we don't go for Hillary. Those people are unionized, you have to work with unions and more of those leftist groups. I mean, I see in the south of the US and the middle of the US, I see a lot more prosperity and a lot more things going on than there. And the reason is easy. If you don't have to allow people all types of really vague things, just say, well, this is what we're going to make, this is a profit on you, and we can pay you something out of it, get a job, get work, and get things out. It's the way to go for, and it's the way that I like the world most best. But let me know what you think about the Trump tax plan and more Trump things. You can tweet me at Lodewijkhof or leave a message below via SoundCloud. Social media is here. Facebook, Snapchat, Twitter, Weibo, blogging, LinkedIn, Swan, Google+. But how to use them in your advantage? Get yourself the Social Media Export course. It's the smart point to use all social media in your advantage without burning all your time. HofProfit.com/SMM. I say HofProfit.com/SMM. I was reading a newsletter and I got a really shocking message. It was from the European Commission. And the European Commission is now launching an initiative to increase the schools in Europe. And increasing schools Europe, European Commission, is not really working for me. And the reason is easy. European Commission is pushing a political agenda and now they are going to set educational policies. And that's not really working together. I mean, I can understand that you say a kid has to read, calculate, know his the history of his country, those things. But what they're now going to do is they're going to train and drill people like, we love high taxes, we love Europe. And there are good things in Europe and there are bad things in Europe. I mean, Europe launched as a free trade initiative, and that's great. I mean, I support free trade. Let's set a simple free trade agreement. We are great free trade. We will not give any sanctions or import duties to each other. We respect each other's laws in each other country. Please put your signature at the mark. Let's get it through Congress and Parliament. We can say a lot of good or bad things about countries, but no one forced you to go to those countries. I am not forced to go to Iran. I don't think it's a smart move for me to go to Iran, but I will not withhold anyone the right to travel visa-free to Iran. Who am I? Go. If you think so, have fun. Now, but what the plan basically will bring is that it will bring child labor in a completely new perspective. And that perspective will be the educational system. Because what you will get is that kids will get brainwashed. They will not learn to think creativity and solve a problem. This is what you need to learn. Solving problems, think creativity. If you have a problem, figure out 21 solutions. 21 and execute them all. I did it when I had that issues with the city of Eindhoven and they went crazy and nuts. I will do it with the neighbor who caused all the problems. I also got from 21 that I need. I have 19. I need 2 more. Then I pull back. I really don't want to know what he will think about it. So it's really to say more that what we need is look at it, think about it. And do you like that some bureaucrat in Brussels decides what your kids is going to go for? I mean, in Europe they talk about the Finnish educational system, how great it is. But the Finnish educational system has a big difference. The teacher has a final objective, what the kids should learn. The way she learns it and additional things, no regulation, and she is the boss. She leads. The bureaucrats of the ministry listen to the teacher. That's the big difference. So, no guidelines on how to do it. And if you look at Helsinki, yeah, that makes sense to learn kids in Helsinki how not to walk under a tram and under a bus and how to use the metro. Well, living in Lapland means how to survive in -20 and shoot a bear. And it's all the same country and the government simply says, let's go that way. And yeah, well, it's just I love Finland. Only what I don't like in Finland is the socialistic way the government has high taxes. But, well, who can be that to be a surprise of? All the listeners love to making some money, but you will have to pay tax upon your money. But that's to change. You can save on your tax. Pay no tax. Completely legal. Start earning more money so you can take care for your beloved ones. So you can travel visa-free. Get yourself the tax-free passport. Get yourself the starting point to a tax-free lifestyle. A lifestyle which is an ultimate freedom. HofProfit.com/passport. I say HofProfit.com/passport. Yeah, it's time to have the main interview of today's show. And the main interview will be on the bankruptcy of Air Berlin. And it's important for you to know, because if an airline goes bankrupt, a lot of things happen, a lot of changes will happen. And for example, Air Berlin went bankrupt and they announced it in advance. There are also airliners who ceased operations by a notice. There were like Monarch and VLM, and they went bankrupt. And Monarch is dead, Air Berlin is dead, VLM had a resurrection from the death. And they are now flying between Antwerp and London, and they're gonna fly big to China. Yes, I'm gonna try to get a VLM guy on the show just to talk about what they are doing, what the plan is, and how lovely the company is. Because yes, VLM was and is a lovely firm in my opinion. Now, what we are gonna chat about is the Air Berlin bankruptcy. My contact was the Mr. Air Berlin nickname. So that was basically how they told him, how they were he was named. And what we are gonna have a look at is, what can you learn from it? It's not really about what you need to do, but what can you learn from having this? Why could you do it? And you can expect more travel and nomad guests in, because I like to inspire you to get yourself a tax-free passport and to travel visa-free. And partly of traveling is flying. So we're gonna have a great interview about it. Let me know what you think about it, because I'm really happy that he is here, because it's unprecedented what happened with Air Berlin's bankruptcy. And we talk a lot of things. We talk business culture, bankruptcy, aviation, the industry. I know him for years, so that's why it's all friendly chats. And well, let me know what you think about it. And here is the interview.
Nice to be there.
The honor is on my side. Your nickname is the Dutch Mr. Air Berlin. How did you get yourself that?
Yeah, basically by working for a very long time for this airline, and always a lot of investing agents in the Netherlands and Belgium. So at some stage, people really see your face as the Air Berlin face in the local market.
Okay, Air Berlin was the sixth largest airline in Europe, and they went bankrupt. That's something that we're going to discuss in this interview. But the Air Berlin story, and how did it grow from a startup to sixth in Europe?
Yeah, so it's quite an old airline, older than most people know it. It started in the 70s already. So Air Berlin almost turned 40. It just didn't. Mm-hmm. And it started with a pilot who was based in Europe. And then due to the oil crisis, he decided to start his own airline, which was Air Berlin. And at that time, only the Allied forces were allowed to start to have an airline in Berlin. Mm-hmm. So the company was registered in orbit, and it started flying like charter destinations. For the first flight was Berlin to Mallorca. And that's the very first start of the airline.
So, and basically, the sixth largest airline of Europe and the second of Germany.
This is how it started. Yeah. And then at the end of the 80s, when the Berlin Wall fell, then there was a German investor needed, and Mr. Joachim Hunold, became the biggest shareholder, and then they registered as a GmbH, like a German entity. Then I was obliged to have a German company. And that's actually where the company really started to take off. Uh-huh. And so after some years, Air Berlin started to fly, for example, also to sell seat-only tickets. So uh-huh. Not just the charter business. And at some stage, next to all the sunny destinations, Air Berlin started to fly city routes like London, Vienna, Barcelona, etc. Uh-huh. And then I entered the company 2003, and then Air Berlin already turned into the second airline of Germany after Lufthansa, obviously. And then this is where the real growth period started. So with a lot of acquisitions and partnerships with other airlines. So for example, the DBA, the Deutsche British Airways was bought.
But
and with that,
if I'm correctly, the money losing BA daughter had a highly profitable local domestic Fokker service flying.
Exactly, yeah.
It was really.
So this was the
Germania
mainly
Expressway.
The I think that was another story. But okay. The DBA, yeah. It was German domestic flights mainly, yeah. and some other destinations. But that was the real focus, and it was so that's a lot of corporate business. So that mm-hmm. was really a new focus area for Air Berlin. And then before that, there was a cooperation with Niki, the Austrian airline of Niki Lauda,
the world famous Formula One driver.
Exactly. Yeah. So after he had sold his first airline, Lauda Air, he was not allowed to use that name anymore. So he just simply used his first name with the next airline. Mm-hmm. And Air Berlin first took a share of 25% in that airline, mm-hmm. It was actually the first low-cost alliance between two airlines.
There's still no low-cost alliance. Well, you see in the world everywhere low-cost airliners start popping up, but they're all competing, yeah. And no one is working together.
Yeah, you do see some cooperation starting between big low-cost airlines and the full-service airlines, mm-hmm. but not that much between real low-cost airlines between each other. They still keep on competing with each
kicking
other.
Kicking each other out of the market, basically. I mean,
yeah,
it's interesting, exactly. Because you said about the service airlines, which you saw, I got a press release from a small boutique airliner in France called La Compagnie, and they started mm-hmm. selling EasyJet tickets, which is makes sense, but La Compagnie is business class only. I was just thinking, yeah, I would also sell it if I would own the company, but if I would fly business class mm-hmm. only, yeah, EasyJet, nice firm, but we are doing something completely different.
Yeah, I mean the full service airlines and the low costers are of course competing more or less for the same clients in Europe, mm-hmm. and so a lot of full service flag carriers do use the feeder network by now. I think Emirates also cooperates with EasyJet, and Norwegian starts cooperating with other airlines. Mm-hmm. Ryanair even does. So yeah, that seems to be a new trend. Anyhow.
Yeah. So yeah. Let's get back to the Air Berlin story. Goals. Well,
yeah. So.
No.
So after Niki mm-hmm. and DBA, and the next big acquisition was the LTU, which also added the long haul destinations to Air Berlin. Mm-hmm. So at that stage, Air Berlin really turned into had a global network with long haul flights, European flights, German domestic flights. And also a mix of corporate business, leisure business. So basically,
an airliner.
Air Berlin really, really started running into a real airline. Yeah.
And just like the Lufthansa, the KLMs, the Air France, just we do everything.
Yeah, but the difference was, of course, that Air Berlin wasn't that big as for example the mm-hmm. Lufthansa Group or LM Air France or BA Iberia. Mm-hmm. But and Air Berlin did have some big orders for Boeing, then for Airbus, like narrow body aircraft later on.
That are the 737s and A320s for our listeners who are not aviation geek. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And later on, Air Berlin had the biggest European order for the Boeing Dreamliner, the 787.
And that was how many?
For I think there were 25 fixed orders and an option for another 25. So at that time, it was the biggest order, yeah.
Because normally you have to pay 1-2% of your total order down already when you sign. So that means a lot of cash out.
Yeah, but in the end, the aircraft were never delivered. Yeah. It was a long-term project. Mm-hmm. And in the end, that never materialized.
Okay. And if you look at Air Berlin, the company had definitely a group of loyal customers who were really happy with them. What was the difference between Air Berlin and the competitors? Because it was partly a low-cost airliner, partly it did basically everything.
Yeah. So one of the at that time really success factors was that Air Berlin had the so-called hybrid model. So it had full service product where everything was like any other airline was included, mm-hmm. but at very very low fares. So and at the time, of course, it was praised very much, this model, and some analysts and strategists said, well, this is the model of the future, and all airlines going to go this way. But I mean, the future turned out a bit different in the end.
Is it also the thing that if you would say, I mean, personally, I hate Ryanair, EasyJet, the Flybe, and I've flown a lot, especially Flybe, because service sucks, everything is bad. But I paid, mostly I flew to the Isle of Man from Liverpool, and it was a ticket of £20 return.
Yeah.
It's just, you pay peanuts, don't expect much. Could that work out? Could it work out if you offer people then free coffee, tea, sandwich, which is always fresh and really good quality, I can say, from experience?
Yeah, I mean, Air Berlin did get a lot of prizes for very good service and very good value for money. So, of course, we attracted loads of passengers and clients with that. But in the end, to be profitable, it's not about having your aircraft full of passengers, but of course, getting enough money for it.
Yeah.
So maybe it would have been a bigger challenge to have full fares and low service to sell that. I mean, it's a bit of a joke, but in the end, of course, airlines can't just sell cheap tickets. It doesn't. In the end, it doesn't work like that.
Yeah. So then, if you look at Air Berlin, what happened? Basically, it was a charter low-cost airliner with some long-haul operations. But if I look at most long-haul flights you had, and my memory serves correctly, it was Beijing, New York, Las Vegas, Caribbean, and South Africa.
Yeah, so near the end, we focus more and more on the United States and Caribbean, because sort of finalize the story, after all these acquisitions and cooperations, also, for example, with TUI Fly, Air Berlin became a member of Oneworld, one of the big alliances. And then at a later stage, Etihad Airways, the airline from Abu Dhabi, the United Arab Emirates, they took a big share in Air Berlin and started the strategic cooperation. So the flights that Air Berlin had, for example, towards Thailand, which was quite a big business, those were stopped at that time. But Air Berlin started flying to Abu Dhabi, for example, and people could fly on with Etihad Airways to all the destinations, basically, in the eastbound side of the world. Yeah.
And Etihad Airways did not decide to leverage on the already existing long-haul network from Air Berlin to the US, to simply use the two hubs you had for most long-haul routes, where I believe Dusseldorf and Berlin, and simply get your European hubs for transfer to there and get the capacity on the US.
Well, after Etihad became an important partner, or the most important partner for Air Berlin, then of course the focus for Air Berlin's own long-haul operation was the other way, so the westbound direction. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the last years, especially the U.S. traffic was increased very much. So there were, at the end, 8 destinations and I think like 10 flights a day to New York, Boston, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Miami, Fort Myers, Orlando, Chicago. So there was a big focus on that destination, and of course that market as well.
It's big. It is the biggest market still, but China is becoming the biggest.
The future, so at some stage Air Berlin did have flights to from Düsseldorf to Shanghai and Beijing. But that didn't work out at all, because but there were some factors coming together that Air Berlin was not allowed to. I think we had to fly a huge detour due to the traffic rights. So and then there was the oil prices, and Air Berlin started out with extremely low fares.
$400 return ticket to China.
Yeah, so I remember we had special agent fares, and a lot of Dutch agents flew for 79 euros round trip to China, just to get people acquainted to the product. But of course, that was extremely cheap. Yeah,
that will not work out, I think, at least from a Dutch perspective. So basically, you say most airlines that fly, and I know that Finnair does, they fly over Russia and Siberia, because it's the shortest route, less flights, less flying hours, so less fuel you burn. And basically Air Berlin had to go the other route because it was not allowed to fly over.
Exactly. Yeah, so the flight time was extremely long, and it cost a lot of fuel. So it was really the worst possible conditions to start these routes. Yeah.
I mean, for our listeners, I believe a co-worker of you who is now engaged in an airline startup who bought 50 long-haul aircrafts, he told to me that 1 hour of those long-haul aircrafts would cost approximately $10,000 just fuel. With 250 seats on board.
Yeah, I don't know that figure, but I can very well imagine that it's correct. And of course, most big airlines, they make their money on the long haul flight, but flights and the network. And so I know for a lot of legacy carriers, the European network, for example, is basically costing money. But they simply need it as a feeder for the long haul flights, where they really, really make the money. But if you don't do it right, you can really lose extremely much money on the long haul. That is the case. Yeah.
Tickets for 79 euros to China is not the proper way to do it. Definitely.
No, I guess not.
Okay. But Air Berlin went bankrupt. How did it happen? What went wrong? Next to selling tickets to China for $80 return.
Yeah, so after all these acquisitions and aircraft orders and I think maybe there was a bit of bad luck. So, like for example, the Berlin airport, the new airport, which was really a big part of the strategy for Air Berlin, it never materialized until today. So, and Air Berlin had a big hub in Berlin, but it was on Berlin Tegel, which is really not made as a hub. It's a point-to-point airport, basically. Mm-hmm. So that was. That was actually a bit of bad luck, but I think a good and solid airline should be able to survive a thing like that. And just the same, the competition, of course, it is very competitive environment, the airline business. But even so, that's also not the real reason. I think the real reason is that in the end, Air Berlin didn't have a clear strategy and a clear positioning in the market. So we were a bit of everything. We were the low cost, we were the charter, we were the long-haul airline, the corporate airline, the leisure airline, and we were simply not big enough to be all of that. So I guess some airlines, like the Lufthansa Group, they are so big that they can afford to have all these fields and have their specific low-cost daughter like Eurowings covering one field or also the touristic and another airline for the premium segment, and have different airlines in different markets like Austria and Swiss and Brussels.
I would just say that, but for our listeners, it was maybe handy to know that if you look at all the airlines Lufthansa has, it's definitely, of course, it's Lufthansa, but it's also the high price but highly ranked Swiss, Austrian from Austria, Eurowings, this is just a German low cost airliner, Brussels Airlines they bought, they have shares in Luxair in Luxembourg. Small but highly high yield market, you told me once. So
yeah,
they are basically in everything. And if an airline is at risk at going down, the company to call to you want to buy the stuff is Lufthansa.
Yeah. No, so I think Air Berlin was too small to do everything. So we really should have made choices a lot earlier to be, for example, only in the touristic business or only in the premium segment. But at least make a clear choice, because I remember like a press release some years ago, and it said, well, this is the new focus, we're going to fly Europe, long haul and touristic. And I was a bit amazed myself, because I thought, this is what we already do, and it's not a focus at all.
It is.
So that is where went wrong a lot of it. Yeah.
It's amazing. I mean, so basically, so that's one of the big things that Air Berlin took down, lack of focus and lack of skill.
Yeah.
If you want to do everything, don't buy one aircraft, buy them at the hundreds, like Emirates does.
Yeah.
Which is big,
So you can just the same for Ryanair. I mean, you can like this airline or you cannot like it, but they are very successful at what they do, because they have a clear strategy. I mean, I don't like their conditions for their staff. I don't think it's in the end, it's not sustainable. But it's successful for quite a long time.
Yeah. Well, if you look at from an investor point of view, if you look at the profits that are made on a passenger, then I believe I once looked at the financial figures of KLM, and they had a turnover of a few billion and made 6 million profit on the 2 few billion. I was thinking, here were the proud of the European airliners who can tackle the low cost. Not working well. Not working well. No flowers from Africa for 2 days, and you're losing money for a year.
Yeah.
And Ryanair reports record high profits. I mean, they are capable of getting the money in. At least they make money, which from a business perspective is great to do.
Yeah, and I think if you look back at the whole history of Air Berlin, so there were really very good things of Air Berlin, like the Mallorca shuttle. This was a concept that was started by Mr. Hunold. So he flew from all the regional airports in Germany, Austria, Switzerland, and later even the Netherlands, Denmark, to Mallorca, where there was a hub, and people could fly on to all destinations in the Spanish and Portuguese mainland, and even the Balearic Islands. And it worked out very well, because people could fly from small airports, let's say Paderborn in Germany, to a relatively small airport in Spain, like Bilbao, and no other airline was really offering that service at that time. So it was a very good concept. But the only thing is that like 15 or 20 years later, there are direct flights between all these cities, for example, by Ryanair. So nobody wanted to fly 4.5 hours instead of 2.5 hours. So that's basically where Air Berlin, it didn't adopt soon enough. This is I found a quote by Mr. Darwin, who said it's not the best or the strongest or the most intelligent animals, or let's say companies, who survive, but the ones who adopt to change. And this is really what went wrong, I think, in the end at Air Berlin, that Air Berlin just didn't adopt to all the market changes soon enough. And I mean, it's kind of easy to say, but I do blame the management for that. But because I think it's in the end their responsibility to have the main strategy in place. Yeah.
And if you look at the end, you saw that one of your biggest shareholders was Etihad Airways, and there was a plan I was told about that basically Air Berlin was going to be split up. You had a leisure airliner and you had one with domestic and business flights, basically.
Yeah. I think that was the right strategy at the end, to really focus on the premium segment and on the niche markets and where you can really earn some money, and take this whole touristic business, which is an interesting business too, but it's so different from the rest. Put that in a separate airline, which was supposed to be Niki, as a European leisure airline, and it was going to be a joint venture with TUI and Etihad Airways, but it just all came too late in the end.
So Air Berlin is now bankrupt. The aircraft went down on the ground. I think we all know the news that your last long haul flight came, and the pilot decided to play a little game.
Yeah.
And he was immediately suspended for 2 months. I was thinking, yeah, well, he is not going to fly in 2 months anyway, so.
I mean, security is a really big issue in aviation, and of course, from that point of view, the pilot should not have done it. But I can sort of understand, also having worked 14 years for Air Berlin, that you don't want to just let such a moment go by unnoticed. So you want to have some kind of memorable action.
Yeah. I mean, in the aviation, I always thought the most memorable moments are the first flight of an airliner and the last flight. The rest is just going on as what you're supposed to do. I mean, I once talked to a former employee of Sabena, and he was basically saying, the moment that the last aircraft came down, and Sabena was also one of the many airlines who collapsed in Europe, and just everyone was looking at it. Just looking. But it was a special moment.
I mean it was pretty much the same, I think, with the last Air Berlin flight. I wasn't there, but it was a flight from Munich to Berlin, and there were extremely much employees at the airport and a lot of press, and it was a very emotional moment for a lot of people. And it is really a fantastic airline coming to an end, so I do I do feel sorry for that too, of course.
Okay, and if we look at the I think it's interesting to see what happened at Sabena, because from Sabena they got another airliner, and I'm pretty sure that some great things are going to happen in the Belgium aviation in the coming years, which we discussed prior to the interview.
Mm-hmm.
Is the same going to happen with Air Berlin?
No, I don't think so. So basically the biggest part of Air Berlin has for the aircraft and a lot of at least flying crew will go to the Lufthansa group. So that is what is happening. And then a smaller part is going to EasyJet, so like 25 aircraft in Berlin. And of course that's all when the European the cartel amt, you know, the antitrust if they all allow it, and especially I think the EasyJet is not really such a big deal for that, but Lufthansa of course is taking the majority and is getting a monopoly on some routes. So I can imagine that some domestic routes have to be given to other airlines, or to be offered at least.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and what do you think that the future of the aviation will bring for Europe?
I mean, when I studied tourism, and that's really more than 20 years ago, my teachers already told me at that time, you will see that let's say 4 or 5 big airlines will emerge, not just European but worldwide. And this consolidation will only go on and on and on. So I guess this is what will happen. So the big three groups, Lufthansa, Air France, KLM, British Airways, Iberia, will keep on growing, will increasingly invest in their own low-cost subsidiaries.
Mm-hmm.
So being, for example, Vueling or Transavia or Eurowings, I think we will really see a lot of Eurowings in the next months and years. And then there's the other big ones like Ryanair and EasyJet. And of course, there's some really big Gulf carriers, some big US carriers. But they're all the alliances. I mean, the traditional alliances, the three. I don't know the future of those, but the real alliances like Qatar Airways is getting stakes in all kinds of airlines worldwide.
Yeah,
that's really a thing to watch out, because that's really mega airlines starting to evolve.
Yeah, to give our listeners an idea, Qatar Airways is the largest shareholder in KTR Pacific. They have a share in, I believe, the second airliner of Europe. They own 10% of BA Iberia. So they could at once simply say to all those airlines, well, your hub is from now on in Qatar. Stop with flying to Asia and Europe and fly in and make a stopover.
And I think what you just mentioned, I think it's even 20% they have in the EIG, the British, British Airways Iberia, and 10% in LATAM, in Latin America. So they're really pretty much everywhere except for USA. They tried it with American, but the Americans are really
anti-Muslim.
Very much against it. Yeah. I don't want to say that, but there's just a thing going on between the US and the Gulf carriers. And but what I do think, Qatar Airways, they do take these shares, but they don't actually tell the airlines only to fly to Doha in Qatar. They do let these airlines do their own strategy, but of course there is a lot of
synergies.
Benefits.
One final airliner that I would like to discuss with you, and the reason is easy, my company has shares in it. What do you think about Hainan from China?
Hainan. Well, you know, actually, when Etihad took their share in Air Berlin, I know the other big interested group was the HNA group, the
company
mother company
Hainan.
Of Hainan. There was another big plan. Mm-hmm. So there would be a lot more flights between Europe, Germany, and China as two big economies.
Mm-hmm.
And Hainan would do all the feedering and add-ons in China. Air Berlin would do it the other way around in Germany. So that would have been, of course, quite an interesting partner as well. Yeah. But
the interesting part, what you saw, I think, when we first met, then Lufthansa just bought a share on Brussels Airlines. I think approximately it was around that time. And you saw that then already Hainan was saying, well, we want to have a European airliner, and simply I got from the investor relation division, I got the plan that they had for Brussels, which is now basically worthless because it's a Lufthansa daughter. And they basically said, well, we had, at that moment they had 14 big hubs in focus cities in China. We're going to fly those 14 to China, to Brussels, and then Brussels takes on, and the management of Brussels Airlines should get Europe profitable, expand to North America, and was thriving on Africa, and should simply add small but highly profitable niches in Africa. Don't go to South Africa where everyone is flying and you're going to lose from everyone. I mean, I believe Air Berlin had 4 or 5 daily flights to South Africa. So if you're one airline with one aircraft, you can't compete. But go to Rwanda, Yemen, or whatever, something like that.
Yeah.
Just.
Yeah, I know actually that, of course, in Europe, we're focused on Europe. But I did hear from Gulf carriers that their biggest, just like you said, actually, the biggest traffic flows are between Asia and Africa that are developing extremely fast. So, and that's also the feeling I had, for example, when I was a few times in Abu Dhabi. It's a totally different world out there, and you see, hey, this is, you know, this is where it's actually all happening, and not maybe not at all in Europe or USA. It's the world economy is changing so fast that
why do you think that I fly a holding incorporated in Hong Kong and I got a working license in Hong Kong also?
Yeah,
there's a reason. There's a reason. Go there where the profits are, and the Middle East is not a smart move for me to go. Most countries would not allow me in, I think.
Okay. Yeah.
The side effect if you have an Israeli passport also. Then a lot of countries, not really a smart move.
Okay, get it.
Yeah, that. What I was trying to say is that I got a note from some people at Brussels Airlines. They fly to Mumbai now, a few times, 6 times a week. And 70% of the people who fly to Mumbai are coming in from Africa. And they were thinking, oh, this route is mainly going to be Belgium, we're going to do diamonds and those type of things. Nope. It's all coming from Africa.
Yeah, I mean another example is that I didn't mention that, but it's for example Jet Airways from India, who had their European hub in Brussels. They moved to Amsterdam, and they have an extremely good cooperation with Air France KLM, and so it's I think 3 or already 4 destinations in India that are linked to Schiphol, and people can fly on with KLM and Delta to the US. So this is a very good joint venture.
Yeah. And don't forget that Jet Airways, when they left Brussels, there was just literally they were planning to move the aircraft to Amsterdam when some lunatics blow themselves up.
And exactly.
Yet, if you blow yourself up, you're a lunatic. No matter what you believe, you're sick.
Mm-hmm.
But that they had then, I believe, 4 or 5 daily flights to New York, and it's really big. And by the way, it's an ATR division, and now, like Air Berlin once was.
Yeah, so I mean, at that time, Air Berlin, of course, did hope that they would move their hub to Düsseldorf, because the same concept with all our US flights would have matched pretty nicely. But they made their own choice, and it were, in the end, it works out very well. They're actually very profitable right now. Yeah.
So is Jet Airways profitable again? I mean, I know a few years ago they were on the verge of collapse, and Etihad took in on the smart way.
By now they are actually doing quite fine. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there any final word you would say to the listeners?
Yeah, so
on the lessons of the bankruptcy of Air Berlin or whatever you want to say.
Yeah,
are you needing a job or something?
Yes, I am. So any nice job offers are welcome. Now, in the end, I realized that, as I also learned once as a student, that every product and every company has its life cycle with a beginning and a middle part and an end. So, so in the end, I realized that now that it really is true, and companies really have to offer good value for money on a long term, and that's what really counts, and make a clear choice and have a good and fair relation with your clients and with all your stakeholders and partners. And I think if you stick to that, then it will work out. And it's the same for the passengers, because if you keep on flying Ryanair and where you know that the conditions for the staff are pretty bad, then yeah, maybe you shouldn't be amazed when at the end stuff like flight cancellations happen because pilots call sick or have too many free days left or whatever. In the end, that doesn't work, the model. So I do believe that we should all work towards sustainability as companies, but also as...
Yeah, and that was it all for today. So let me know what you think about it. I look forward to hearing back from you. Let me know what your weekend plans are. My weekend plan is cooking for a friend and having some great talks. So that's it. Yeah, we're gonna have wraps, tortillas and steaks or whatever I can get my hands upon for an affordable price. I look forward to hearing back from you. Leave me a message. You can tweet me at @LodewijkHolf. You can leave a comment below on SoundCloud and make it a lovely moment. And don't forget, there are great products on hofprofit.com. Get them all and I will talk to you on Monday. Cheers!